So tonight we have our first week with Wally P, and I would like to introduce you to him. Take it away, Wally.
Thank you. I'm Wally P, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Wally.
My sober date is March 20th of 2009. I have a sponsor, and I have a service sponsor, and he's a great service sponsor. I'm saying that because he's here. You know, by the grace of God, you know, I've got into these rooms, so far, so good, you know. And I want to share with you some wisdom that is really just about, this is what works for me, guys. And this is how I've kind of learned this thing. I have a knack for breaking down complex into simple in my other life. So that's what I wanted. I wanted to kind of learn how to do that, but there's no simple task. This is all a God thing. So the funny thing is that everything starts with a coincidence, right? So I was preparing for the handouts that some of you got, and I look at the front, and this is what I put. I put the prescription that Dr. Bob, which is actually it's right up at that windowsill right there. So I put this not knowing that I was going to be staring at what I'm putting on this document. So I guess I'm meant to be here. We'll see if I last until next year. So what I've broken this down to is a series of prescriptions that Dr. Bob had. The first one is trust God, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. The second week is going to be about clean house. And the last one is going to be help others. And there are some sponsors of mine that say you need number four, which is mind your own business. You know? But that's another story. We're not including on that one. So... I'd love to get that prayer, too. I love that prayer.
Okay.
Yeah, I love
that. I'll get that.
All right. So let's start with step one. So there are certain principles that each step represent, and I put them right next to the step one. Step one is the honesty principle, you know. So we were powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. So the readings for this stuff is on the big book. You have Doctor's Opinion, chapters 1 and 3, and there's some other stuff. And I broke down a couple of sections, but also the 12 and 12, step 1. So even though there's a big book, I'm just going to go to what I like is the condensed version, the summary of step 1 from the 12 and 12. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Admission of powerlessness is the first step in liberation. Relation of humility to sobriety. Mental obsession plus physical allergy. Why must every AA hit bottom? I love that there's a question there, you know? And I'm going to have a couple questions for you after each step, too. So, the directions in the big book of AA, which is page 30, if we could turn, if you have a big book, if not, I have it in the handout. Page 30, paragraph 2. It reads like this. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we were like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. Has to be smashed. And I remember when I got sober, I had a guy who was one of these guys that knew the big book, big time. He was a guy that would say, Bill Story, he gets thrown out of the cab. What's the name of the cab driver? I mean, one of those things. It's like, what? You know, you have Trekkies and you have, you know, this guy, you know. You know, this is like Thumper to another level, you know. So, but Ricky did me justice. He ended up being my sponsor. We moved on. But he taught me the big book. And the first thing I wrote in my big book, in the front, and the blank page after he told me I didn't know anything, that's kind of what happened. He says, you know nothing. That's kind of what this page is. So I'm going to put, so he says, write your date of your sobriety date. You write that date, your name, and make sure that doesn't change. Then he said, three things you got to write underneath. What are you going to write? Sex, food, and money. Because those are the others. You know, and I go, okay. So he went on to say a lot of things, you know. And but one of the things that he did discuss is in the doctor's opinion. All right? So if we could turn to the doctor's opinion. If not, I have the handout on page Roman numeral. This is how you got to read this. Roman numeral XXV111 or 23. And where are we looking at? We're looking for, we believe, right at the top there. So, this is a discussion regarding the allergy of the body. Okay? We believed, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomena of craving is linked to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become difficult to solve. So, I got to just tell you that when I read this doctor's opinion, and my father had an opinion too, he was a doctor. My father was a child psychiatrist. And I used to go, Dad, let's go have a catch. He goes, I can't, I'm reading this book. The book was How to Play with Your Child. I don't know why Cats in the Cradle is my favorite song. You get to. So his opinion was not my best opinion, you know. But when I read this, and I remember part of my story is the fact that, you know, you have this allergy of the body. And, you know, and kind of like everybody says they had a drinking problem. We were just talking about that before the meeting. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't have really a drinking problem. I had a stopping problem, right? I didn't understand what that was. Why is it that I just, you know, I go to town. I thought it was like something that I could make money with. This is a trait, you know. I need a job that can use this ability, right? Right. That's what I kind of need, you know. So I thought it was like a good virtue, you know. That's really what I thought it was. I didn't know it was an allergy. So when you think of allergy, you're like, oh, you take something and you're like, oh my God, I'm breaking out, you know. Well, of course, now it happened once where I did break out in handcuffs, you know. So that's what happens, you know, or silver they say sometimes. So that's the one thing I got to tell you. In regards to the allergy of it, I started learning about the allergy of it. And I could remember, while I'm getting sober, all these things in the past that happened where people would say things to me after I would drink a lot. They would say, and my wife would say, like, you know, I think you're allergic to it, you know? And I would just say, what? Oh, no, I just didn't have enough to eat, you know? Six bottles of wine was, you know. But no, there was no food. There was no food there. You know, that was a great allergy. But she would say about the allergy, and then when I read this, I go, did she read this book? You know, behind my back? What's going on? You know? So I remember that. The next part we're going to skip to is talk about the obsession of the mind. So if we could turn to Big Book page 23. 23 is that we know that a while. Let's see. I'm sorry. Right at the bottom of 22, going to 23. My bad. Okay. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men or women. We are equally positive that once we take any alcohol whatsoever in his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. These experiences of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why they started on the last bender, the chances are that they will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Maybe 1,000. Yeah, I got probably 1,000. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really makes sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking, the bouts create. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can feel the ache. If you draw this reasoning to the attention of the alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Anybody fit that description in his room? Check. So the obsession of the mind, and you're looking at this allergy thing, and you're looking at this obsessions thing, and what I started realizing is that, and just so you know, just to give you a little point of reference for me, what made me aware that I was an alcoholic was the state of New Jersey, okay? Wonderful program they have, because I got a DUI in another state that had reciprocal problems, and I was 23 years young. And it wasn't my fault, by the way, you know, why I got, you know, pulled over, you know, because I was at a bachelor party, and there were supposed to be two women dancing that night. One got sick, and we ended up going downtown for this guy's bachelor party, and I was the one less drunk. So I was the responsible alcoholic in that picture. And we got stopped, and I blew a .09 whatever something. Uh-huh. And anyway, that wasn't good enough. He still took me downtown. And what was funnier, seeing all the guys in my car blowing and seeing if they could drive. Whoa! 1.5! Whoa! So I was... But it wasn't my fault, of course. So I get arrested, and I was 23. I ended up going to this class all day, and they basically... They started playing videos of the alcoholic, and I'm going, and I swear to God, it was like, that's me, you know? I watched myself in this video, you know, and then I'm like, yeah, I could, okay. Then there was this speaker that was there from AA shows up, which I didn't know if it was AA. I thought he was a really nice guy, you know? Just showed up for the hell of it. Maybe he's a counselor getting paid for this, whatever. And he told me the best blackout story ever. I'm like, yeah, because I was a blackout drinker, you know? He says, yeah, you know, I was at this bar, it was in the winter, and you know, and it was a yada, 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 you know. I come to, and it's like, you know, all these people in a room in Puerto Rico at this hotel. So just to take you back to the yada, yada, the guy, after like 19,000 Jägermeisters, you know, he ends up with the corporate card, you know, private jet. Let's go somewhere warm. Everybody in the bar's coming, you know. And I'm sitting there going, "Whoa, this guy's got a problem," you know. Yeah, but I can identify with this guy, you know. I can identify with it, you know. So I was kind of like, I think, you know, I was into myself. I was saying, I think I'm an alcoholic, you know. And then they get you one-on-one with the guy. He says, "I see here you got a job. It's your first offense. Yeah, get out of here," you know. I was ready for him to say, you know, maybe you should think about rehab or think about AA. Nothing, right? I walked out of there. I was like, you know, and I was very confused, but you know how more will be revealed later, right? So someone in my family saw that and said, hey, would you like to come to a meeting? So I went to a meeting in the Upper East Side. I think it was a chain smoking meeting because everybody was smoking, you know? And there was a speaker there just like me, and the guy's up there and he's saying, yeah, you know, when I drank, you know, I could drink a case of beer in college. I'm like, yeah, check. Because, yeah, then I went to gin. I was really good at gin. Gin, yeah, I did that too. And then all of a sudden, you know, I lost my family. I lost my job. I was in a YMCA. I didn't want to go to the hospital after stuff started coming out of me, blood from, because they'd make me stop drinking. I'm going, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is way too intense for me, you know. I need the 100 level, you know. So my friend said, what do you think? I said, nah, it's not for me. So I needed to do more research, you know. But I didn't know, I didn't have the time to really understand allergies of the body, allergies of the mind. But I saw a video, okay, the state of New Jersey, you know. So I knew I was an alcoholic. It was always in the back of my mind. I needed to do a little bit more research, you know. And, but what ended up happening is that my disease became elegant. You know, my dad was a wine drinker, and that was my first drink at 14. He was an alcoholic too. Never, you know. By the way, as a psychiatrist, isn't it funny if you're a psychiatrist? Why is it you don't have one book on alcoholism? Anyway, that's another story. He died before I could ask him. So what ends up happening is that at 14, little glass of wine, boom. So after I went to AA, you know, I said, wow, I got to start controlling my, you know, no more hard liquor. I got to just go with wine. Okay? So I learned about, you know, why sometimes they have the Chardonnays that are buttery, you know. I learned it's called malolactic fermentation, right? That, I need some of that malolactic fermentation stuff, you know. It was very fancy. But then I tell my wife, yeah, listen, I'm going to stay up and watch David Letterman. I never stayed up to watch David Letterman ever. I drank another bottle. It wasn't malolactic this time. It was whatever was available. And then I put the empty in my car because she'll never know, all right? She'll never know. So it turned on, you know, it turned on itself. But it took me from that AA meeting that I went to that I knew I was an alcoholic until I was 39 to get back in these rooms, right? And I call it the gift of desperation, right? So what happened? So what happened was, and it starts with a God wink. You know, I started with a God wink. My story's got a God wink in there too. So I was in Summit. And I started my habits going back to the to a local watering restaurant where I would go during lunch and have the excuse that it's lunch so I could have some buttery Chardonnay. All right? The bartender was like, hey, buttery Chardonnay, they called me. Hey, buttery. So, yeah. Which, by the way, I said that the other day at a meeting, and my sponsor looked back and goes, you should be ashamed of yourself. And the guy next to me was, yeah. So there I am. Yes, okay, thanks. Don't worry, there was vodka involved. All right, pop. I had a bottle of pop-off, too. Take it easy. But at least the pop-off, right? So there I am. The last day I drank, I was at Roots, right? Terrible place. Buttery Chardonnay. A guy shows up that I invited because I would justify drinking with someone new because that's the business lunch, you know? Shows up, he's got this beautiful jacket on with a camel pin. And I say, Roger, let's go at the bar. I know the bartender. So he already had two Chardonnays in me, butteries, right? So I get in there. Roger has this beautiful pin about a camel. Uh-huh. You know, I go, Roger, what's up with your pin? Now, he got into his whole story of why he stopped drinking. And I should have known that was going because he ordered a root beer. Right? And I'm going, so I'm not paying. I go, Paul, can I get a water? You know, I don't want to think I'm an alcoholic or anything like that, you know? So he tells me his whole story that this camel is a symbol of sobriety, that a camel could go for days without, you know, liquid, and it gets on its knees to get up and knees to get down and blah, blah, blah. I can't really remember, but I kind of go, all right, whatever. Roger left. I came back to the bar later. That night, I ended up going home and put one on. I put one on, and I blacked out in my times, in my past, several times. This time was different because I woke up with all my clothes on, you know, the Irish pajamas, no offense. You know, I'm sitting there and with my shoes on, my jacket. I don't know how I got there. It was 4:07 in the morning. So I took all my clothes off, right, because I had to try to get away with this again. So I put my clothes in the closet, went upstairs into the darkness. I am now married with two kids, you know. And through the darkness, my wife says, you have to apologize to Natalie, Wally. You hit her last night. you know. So after a tear was in my eye, the other thing that was in my eye was this picture of a camel. Why did I meet this guy that day? So, you know, now I know why. I kind of know why. So I ended up calling Roger the next day and told him what happened. And he told me to come to a meeting. And it was in Summit. And I started going to meetings in Summit at 7:15 in the morning, because I walked into one meeting and the lady said, "You're the newcomer. You're the most important person in the room." And I said, "That's what I've been saying." You know? But before that, I want to take you guys to, you know, I remember my first year seeing all these guys walking into AA meetings with AA t-shirts, right? And I didn't know they were AA t-shirts. I just said, why has this guy got this thing called "I Am the Man" on page 21? Right? Did you ever see that t-shirt, anybody? "I Am the Man" on page 21. All right?
We're going to sell some after the... I'm just kidding.
So let's turn to page 21 of the big book. And let's read this. And the first thing is we're going to read this. I'm going to change the name where you have pronouns. And basically what's going to happen is you're going to just put your name where it's the pronoun. So I'll say, "Here is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. Wally does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. Wally is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Wally is seldom mildly intoxicated. Wally is always more or less insanely drunk. Wally's disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little." Who wrote that one? "Wally may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let Wally drink for a day, and Wally frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. No. Wally has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Wally is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, Wally is incredibly dishonest and selfish. Wally often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitude, and has a promising career ahead of him. Wally uses his gift to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Wally is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated that he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early next morning, Wally searches madly for the bottle that he misplaced the night before. If Wally could afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, Wally begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he could go to work. That's when Popoff kicks in, right around there, you know. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. So I am the man on page 21. Anybody identify that? Yeah. So step one is all about this stuff, identification, right? With this disease, you know? And I got to tell you, it wasn't easy, but when I started realizing the checklist, I'm like, check, 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 yeah? So, but it was good to find that, you know, this is somewhere that I can identify all these things. What now, you know? Well, the good thing is that on the big book, page 27, we're going to move over there, because guess what? There is a solution. Not there's 67 solutions or 25 solutions. There's one solution, okay? And I love the story of Roland Hazard, the guy that is the loaded, he's a very rich dude that wants to cure this alcohol thing. So he tries to get Freud. He's not around. And then he tries to get the other Freud disciple, Adler. He's not around. But this guy, Carl Jung, took him. You know, hey, I'll take this guy. My dad didn't have any books on Carl Jung. I want to know. He had Adler, and he had the other guy. You know, I got to get on a Ouija board or something. Talk, ask him. You know, any psychics here, let me know, please. All right, so there is a solution. Let's go to page 27 here, and let's just talk about this a little bit. the doctor, who is Carl Jung, and now for those that don't know, he said that you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover. That's hope right there, right? Let's hope when your doctor says that, right? Where the state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Now, just so you know, a little background. This guy would try to get sober, and he's fine. Oh, great. Then he leaves, gets hammered, comes back. I just can't stop drinking, you know? And he says to the doctor, there is no exception. Is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor. Well, there is, you know? Exceptions to this case, have, such as yours, have been occurring ever since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what's called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Now, I read that and I go, here's this doctor who makes his living prescribing drugs, right, or whatever the psychotherapy was, right? And it's like going to Dr. DeBakey, that heart surgeon dude, and you know what? He says, you know what, maybe you should just, you know, think about homeopathy, you know? Maybe some breathing will do, breathing exercises and meditation. That means I don't want to get paid. Why don't you go try something else, an alternative thing, right? And you know what? For Carl Jung to say that, that took a lot of ego deflation. And if you read a lot of stuff about Carl Jung, you realize that he was at a stage in his life where he had meaning, right? At the first stage, he had ambition, and then he shifted to meaning, you know? And that's I look at that and I say, wow, I've got hope that there is a solution, right? And the good thing is that there's one solution, right? And from what I gather from talking with my sponsor, going to big book meetings, is that it's different for everybody, but there's one solution, right? So if everybody in this room, if I'm saying buttery Chardonnay, some people are going, okay. Other guys are going, what? Right? It's like when guys start sharing, like my grandfather, an early moment of when I knew I was an alcoholic, when I look back, my grandfather was this dude, when I was 14, no, I was like 10, we would go somewhere, and my grandfather would drink highballs. You know, you know, they're a drunk because every gift you give them is alcohol, right? Or something to drink it with, or whatever. You know, it's like, all right, you know, they're alcohol. So we would give him this big ass JB thing. You know, like I knew who Johnny Walker was like at 10. You know what I mean? Like, I want to meet this guy. You know? Johnny Walker Black. So we're at a party, and I'm sitting next to my grandfather, and they're drinking some freaking whiskey. And then all of a sudden, the host comes and says, "Hey, look, I've got the Johnny Walker Black." And he says, "For you, Grandpa." Here, pours Grandpa a little, and he says, "Oh, thank you." And then my grandpa goes, "That's the same shit we were drinking before." And I was like, "Wow, my grandfather's really great. He knows the difference, you know." Is that an alcoholic thought or what? You know, I want to be like him one day. I want to grow up to be just like him and tell the difference between the shit stuff he was feeding them. And, you know, I mean, crazy. It's just insanity, right? So, I segue. I think my Adderall's running out right now. So, just, you know, bear with me. Tom, just make sure I'm doing okay, right? All right, so let's talk about the dash. Has anybody ever talked to you guys about the dash? Okay? What is the dash? Right? Because I think that one of the myths of this first step, and I find myself screwing it up until I learn this. You know, you think about it, it's like, tell me, what's the first step in AA? They say we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. That's wrong. Right? Because it's like, and my life began. So, okay, I got two. So now, as alcoholics, we'll be like, oh, I don't have both of them. Okay. So, okay, so I don't need to be here then. Okay. But I think that the dash is put on there for a reason, right? We don't know if it's true, right? people have studied this book, and even the guys, I think Bill didn't even know what the hell he was doing sometimes. He had a thesaurus, I know that. So let's talk about this. I wrote this a little bit. It says that the word "and" is not in step one. But there is a dash. Right? There's a dash, right? Our English language, when a hyphen or a dash is not used to break up a word, it is used to connect a thought or a phrase. So let's paraphrase step one. As it's written, using the dash as a concluding thought rather than "and." I could say that I admitted that I am powerless over staying sober, dash, because I cannot manage to leave alcohol entirely alone. Or, dash, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, dash, alone, we could not manage to leave alcohol entirely alone. The insanity of the first drink, the obsession that prevents us from leaving alcohol alone, dash, while we are entirely sober, this then means, dash, that my life has become unmanageable, dash, regardless if I was drinking or sober, dash, because I cannot manage to leave alcohol entirely alone. Get the point here? So we know from the doctor's opinion and from all our experiences that it's not safe for us alcoholics to use alcohol in any form at all. If it is unsafe for us to use alcohol in any form at all, we cannot manage to leave alcohol entirely alone, dash, we are powerless over drinking alcohol. Right? There's like catch-22s left and right, right? So I think that it's important to say, not "and," but awareness and acceptance. I think there's awareness of alcoholism has to be connected with a dash, right? And dash is because I knew I was an alcoholic at 23. I just wasn't willing to accept it. Something had to happen. And everybody here drank different things. Everybody liked whiskey. They liked, you know, they liked buttery Chardonnay, you know. They all liked the vodka anyway, right? I'm sure everybody's going, oh, you know, I'd like to sit and curl up with a book next to a fire just to sip a little Jägermeister. Nah. Oof. So the point is that everybody got drunk different here. Everybody got drunk different, but we get sober different. We get sober different even though there's only one solution. But that dash has to appear in your life. For me, you know, they say one of the L's has to pop up, right? The liver, the lover, or the lawyer, right? So the dash pops up in my life with hitting a kid in a blackout. She was six, right? She was six then. She doesn't remember me ever drinking. Now she just says, she talks to me now, she says, "Where's mom?" That's all she says. She goes, "Where's mom, and can I get some money, you know?" So, but she's great. She's a good kid. And she's never seen me drunk, all right? You know, by the grace of God. So I think for you guys, I just want you to ask these questions to yourself. So one of the things I think is great is journaling, right? So when I do this with sponsees, we go through the steps, and after each step, just to get you warmed up, you know, when did you become aware that you were an alcoholic? You know, can everybody remember where they were? There I was, you know. When did you become aware you were an alcoholic? And then the second question is, when did you accept you were an alcoholic? You know? That's very, very important to have both, you know? So that's a great beginning of that, all right? And if you ever think that your life is not unmanageable, well, if you think it is, just check the tree. I put a little tree of unmanageability, right? So all this is a wonderful tree. It's a visual depiction, because I'm a very visual person. So I need to see proof, you know? I heard a lot about all these things, but I want to see proof. Then when I saw this, this is pretty cool, you know? So I have that. We could talk about that, but there's a lot of good stuff in that. All right, so we're going to move into step two. Okay? How are we doing on time? Doing good?
Yeah, quarter after.
Perfect. All right. Step two. Hope. Step two is hope. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So, let me read the summary in the 12 and 12. What can we believe in? AA does not demand belief. 12 steps are only suggestions. Importance of an open mind. Varieties of ways to faith. Substitution of AA as higher power. Plight of the disillusioned. Roadblocks of indifference and prejudice. Lost faith found in AA problems of intellectuality and self-sufficiency. Negative and positive thinking. Self-righteousness. Defiance is an outstanding characteristic of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. You think?
Yeah.
Step two is a rallying point to sanity. Right relation to God. So, what I'm going to say about this point is that I had nothing to do with this. All right? And when I sit down with people to talk about God or whatever it is, believe me, I had a lot of issues because I grew up going to Catholic school and I had nuns that would tell me what to believe, you know? I was the kid that was, I mean, let me tell you, it was traumatic, you know? I was traumatic because I ate so much soap, these nuns would make me eat soap, right? And I would go home and watch TV, and it was a commercial for Irish Spring. Remember that one? The guy Irish Spring, and he grabbed the bar, and he cut it. And my mouth would salivate. I'd go, why can't we get that soap? That looks delicious, you know? I go to soap stores now and get hungry. It's terrible. Go figure. All right. So, in the big book here, let's turn to page 47. If you want to, I'll wait if you want. Page 47, paragraph 2. Okay? 47, paragraph 2. Make sure I'm right here. The section where it says, we need to ask, right? I love when you ask questions, right? We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. And I think this is where you got to kind of understand that for me, I needed to have that moment of unmanageability. I still fear alcohol. I still picture my wife telling me that. And I mean, I could have killed my kid in hindsight, right? But, you know, the problem with my mind as an alcoholic is I get confidence, right? That's why I have no defense against the first drink, nor do I want to test that, you know? We see a sign, but something tells me that my life became unmanageable. But here's the thing about the exercise. I'm going to go into the assignment here for you guys. So what does it mean to be restored to sanity? Right? The coolest thing is discussing with other alcoholics what you did while you were drinking that was insane. Right? People laugh. You know, it's not great material for Al-Anon. People laugh in here. You go to Al-Anon with that, forget it. Yeah? But, you know, what is the most insane thing that you did, you know, while drinking? And I could tell you, you know, there's things about driving. There's things that I did. I mean, I remember going to conferences traveling on conferences and putting one on to the point where the next morning I walk into a room of people and they all know me. They all know me, like, well, hey, you know, and I just walk in. I walked into, like, is this my intervention? What's going on? You know? You were crazy last night. I'm like, ooh, okay. So, and that's not because I had a drinking problem. That's because I have a stopping problem, you know? And that's really what happened. But a lot of things were insane, you know? But let me tell you, when I learned about insanity, it's best driven by this thing I'm going to read you. The 12, how many heard of this? 12 steps of insanity. Anybody? Well, let me read them to you. So you have 12 steps of sanity, right? Well, let me tell you about the 12 steps of insanity. One, we were admitted we were powerless over nothing, dash, that we could manage our lives perfectly and those of anyone who would let us. Two, came to believe that there was no power greater than us. We believed God didn't take direction well and the rest of the world was insane. Step three, made a decision to have our loved ones turn their wills and their lives over to the care, even though they could not understand us. Four, made a searching and fearless moral and inventory of everyone we knew. Five, admitted to the world and to God the exact nature of everyone else's wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to make others change using our self-will and directing God on how to help. Seven, demanded others and God to do our will because we were just right. Eight, made a list of all persons that who would have harmed us and became willing to go to any length to get even with them or at least turn to our addiction for comfort. Nine, got direct revenge on such people wherever possible, except would to do so would cost us our lives or at least a jail sentence. 10, continued to take inventory of others, and when we were wrong, promptly and repeatedly told them about it. 11, sought through complaining, addiction, and medication to improve our relations with other and God, asking only that they do things in our way. And step 12, had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of these 12 steps, we blamed it on others and God, trying to gain sympathy and pity in all our affairs. That's insanity. And you know what? When I read that at the beginning, because I don't know, you could tell guys that are new, because they wouldn't laugh at this.
Right.
You know? And that's how you tell. You know, there's a rule number 62 in the 12 and 12, right? What is that rule number 62? Anybody?
Don't take yourself
too damn serious. Right? When you walk in here, everything's serious.
Right.
Everything's serious. So the insanity of reading this is that, you know, and when I wrote five things or 15 things that I did insane, the guy I was working these steps with, he said, you know, you forgot to write one down. I said, what was that? He goes, that after some of those, you still drank. You know, that's the insanity of our disease. That we could do the worst thing. We could take a lie detector and say we're not going to freaking do this ever again. Then all of a sudden, bring out your best. You know, it becomes, you know, it's just crazy. It becomes insanity, right? But something lets us know that, you know, something made me aware. Why is it that all these times that I drank and I blacked out and I was stupid and I was arrested and I lost money and I made people do things that I knew right off the bat were to my benefit, not theirs? Why all these things now? Am I now, I got to stop drinking? What, who or what made me realize that? That was not me, you know? Because my best decisions got me here. Got me to sit in a room or in a jail cell, you know? So something greater than myself got me to realize that. So when I sit with somebody and they say, well, what God is it? Is it Jesus? Is it the Jewish God? Is it, you know? Is it Buddha? And I say, how about anybody that'll take you right now? You know? So everybody's got that power. You know, and I always think of like analogies of that moment, because you have that voice. I have that voice been talking to me all my life. And, you know, you talk about like movies like Animal House, where it's like, do this, don't do that. The devil, you know, pops up. The angel pops up, you know. Always it pops up. You're hearing yourself talk here, there, you know. So, but now for some reason, my wife's voice in the darkness was enough, you know. And my actions, which I don't even remember doing, was enough to say, I am so done with this. Where else can I go with complete people in a room to tell you guys that I hit my kid in a blackout, right? No other place. No other place. But you know, we're wounded healers, because I'm a wounded healer because of that, right? If I could help someone give that person hope that life goes on after that crap happened, I'm telling you it does. It does. Because I haven't had a drink since then, you know? 9 years. Doesn't mean I'm not insane. You could ask Tom. He knows I'm crazy. Right, Tommy? Thank you. Thank you for vouching. So step two is the hope, baby. Let's move to step three. Step three is faith. Right? Now, this is the whole point here that, you know, I remember the guy said, hey, you want to come to a retreat? He says, well, where is it? It's at this retreat house up in Morristown. He said, Matt Talbot retreat. Well, what kind of retreat is that? It's a spiritual retreat. What's the difference between religious, right? And, of course, me, nuns, soap, I'm thinking, you know, what kind of soap they got? Is it liquid soap? Now they have the liquid soap now, you know. No, it's a spiritual retreat. The difference between spirituality and religion is as it's religious people are afraid of going to hell. Spiritual people have already been there, don't want to go back. I said, okay, I got it. So, ain't that the truth? So step three is faith. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. In the original text, it had and direction. I kind of need that, you know? Care is fine, but I need direction. And if you ask, you'll get some direction. Maybe it's not what you want, but you get direction. So let me read it to you here from the 12 and 12 summary. Okay? Step three, it says, is like opening a locked door. How shall we let God into our lives? Willingness is the key. Dependence as a means to independence. Dependence as a means to independence. That's key. No, willingness is the key. Dangers of self-sufficiency. Turning our will to higher power. Misuse of willpower. Sustained and personal exertion necessary to conform to God's will. All good stuff. In the big book, it's page 63. Okay? Page 63, paragraph 2, where it says we're now at step 3. And if we're going to read this, we might as well all say it together, right? It's for third step prayer. So it says, so we are now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victories over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy will, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I love the word abandon, you know? What does abandon make you think of? Like, I mean, I think someone says that Bill's trying to use different fancy words, right? To change it up a little bit. But to abandon ourselves utterly to him is to just say, okay, you're in charge, bro. you're driving, you know? And it's a very important thing to kind of look at what that means, you know? What does it mean to abandon or turn your will or your life over to the care of anybody or anything, right? Because, you know, the other thing I found out, besides having this controlled drinking problem, is this other problem that I had. You know what that was? Guess. Control. Now, I learned that in Al-Anon. I went to a couple Al-Anons meeting, and I just sponsors a bunch of guys that they drive me to Al-Anon, you know? But it's a great, great fellowship. And I got to tell you, control. How many people you think that besides drinking, they have control problems? Exactly. So the surrender part of this step, right, is you have to have faith, right? But something has to give you what? If faith is on that side of the cliff over yonder, and I'm over here sitting in fear, I got to get over to that, you know, it's like, remember that movie in Indiana Jones, that one where he goes and he says he's got the cliff and he's got to have faith, right? And he realizes, he steps forward and it's a bridge in front of them, right? You have to trust, right? I remember the other analogy. He says one time, remember the Brady Bunch went to the Grand Canyon, right? And Alice is in the little burrito, like, you know, that little mule? You ever been there? You get to go down. And the ledge is very, very, you know, narrow. You know, you're sitting there trying to go down and around. You got to trust this little beast to take you around. That's what AA is like. You got to sort of trust that this is going to work, you know, if you surrender and you do all the things that you're told to do, right? And surrender is tough for me, you know? It's tough. To change not everything, not one thing, but everything, people, places, and things, oh my God, you know? So one of the assignments is to say, write about turning your will over to God of your understanding. So why is it that you don't start at step 3? Because I want you to think about this. Who are you going to turn your will over? All your junk. Eventually you're going to use, it's like recycling, right? You know, like, I knew like 25 people selling houses, downsizing, moving out, and these guys are just trying to get rid of all their crap, right? So just think about that. If you have all this crap within you, and you don't have the dumpster company to go to, it's in vain. You can pile it all up, you can categorize it all, but if you don't have that delivery service to come grab it from you, it's in vain. So you need to connect to whatever that higher power is so they can come take away that crap from you. You can't surrender to something you don't know, right? That's why we're agnostics. Because I know there's, you get into a heated debate here on being an atheist. And I have a friend that's an atheist who says, well, I don't believe in anything. Well, that's a belief in something. Belief in nothing is a belief in something. Right? So you're really agnostic. Or a control freak that doesn't want to admit it. Right? That's what I am, you know. But then I admitted it, and now I'm always agnostic, right? I'm open-minded. So the abandonment. So how did I turn my will over to God of my understanding? Changing my behaviors and perspective on life, right? I mean, I got to tell you, it's like the thought, oh, I used to think humility was going to a bar and buying guys around, you know? Let me buy everybody shots. I'm a humble guy, you know? Hey, forget about it, you know? But what I could tell you is that, and then the other thing is, you know, my mother's another issue in my life, right? She's always on my fourth list, right? Every time I've done my steps, she's always appeared, you know? I try. I think I need like an AA exorcist or something. My mother would come into town. My mother's from Costa Rica. My family's from Costa Rica. Yes, I'm not Italian. I'm Costa Rican. So my mother would come into town, and I go, Mom, you're going to be here for a week. Let's not talk about my weight or God, okay? And she sits down, and she goes, we're having lunch, and she goes, are you going to say grace, gordito? Gordito, translated, is chubby guy, you know? She installed the buttons, right? But her interpretation of religion, like, you know, I say I just went to church this morning to my 7:15 meeting. My home group's the BYLC group in Summit at 7:15, and I come home and I said I went to church. She said that doesn't count, right? That doesn't count. So she's keeping score, you know. Mm-hmm. So my behavior and perspective on life, I'm like, that's what she. I've got to basically say, well, great, Mom. Whatever makes you happy, I'll take you to church. I started saying yes to things mm-hmm. that I was saying no to before because it was all about me, right? And things started getting better, mm-hmm. you know, when I started letting go a little bit, you know? Then someone suggested, maybe you start a gratitude list. It's like, what is gratitude? What, you know, the word gratitude, you know, I mean, it's funny when you start hanging out in the world, you start finding the guys in AA. Why? Because they're all these guys at AA-isms, you know? Like, I've been in meetings where guys go, my clients are happy, joyous, and free. And I'm like, oh, they are? They are? And he goes, yeah, you know, easy does it. Or, you know, you see all these things, and they are in recovery 20 years, 15 years, you know? So the gratitude list is awesome, you know? So one of the things I do with my sponsees and with guys coming back, whatever, is I say, text me three things you're grateful for every day. And it makes me text them three things I'm grateful for, right? So I'll tell you one quick story on gratitude. So I go to this retreat. We bring homeless guys from Ava's Village to Loyola for a ministry that I've been doing for 8 years. First time we separate to get to know each other, and they say, okay, where are you from? What's your favorite team? In the morning, do you say any prayers? I say, well, I told this guy, who's 62 years old, homeless, you know, African-American fella, and, you know, he asked me, I said, well, I pray always for a Godwink, proof of life, you know, like, have God reveal himself to me. Because I need some proof. You know, I was early on sobriety. And the guy looks at me and goes, what's the matter? Waking up isn't good enough for you anymore? Mm. And I was like, who's on retreat here, man? You know? But every morning now, I always say, awoke sober. Mm. Because I took it for granted. He reminded me of that, you know? So I'll remind you that. Mm-hmm. And let me close this session by basically giving you a little carrot. For those that are thinking, what's down the road? So there's a great piece that has the bedevilments on page 52. Mm-hmm. You guys are familiar with bedevilments. If you're not, they're on page 52. Mm-hmm. And they on the opposite, they're the nine-step promises. Nine-step promises are on page 83. There's 31 pages, right, in between. So when you're reading the script of an alcoholic, during this phase of the bedevilments, he says, we're having trouble with personal relationships. The promise is we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. The bedevilments say we couldn't control our emotional natures. The nine-step promise says we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. We were prey to misery and depression. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. We couldn't make a living. The fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We had a feeling of uselessness. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We were full of fear. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We were unhappy. But we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how your experience can benefit others. And we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And most of all, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Hell yes. That's the end of step three. And that's the end of my talk on Trust God.
Okay. Thank you. So the meeting is now open for comments, observations.